Super Science News.
Willkommen bei Super Science Me, Wissenschaft und Fiktion, auf Radio Orange 94.0 und als Podcast. Heute mit einer deutsch-englischsprachigen Ausgabe zu Nature/Nature. Eine Sendung von Julia Grillmeier. Ich sitze in einem Garten in Simmering, unter einer Trauerweide. In dieser Trauerweide singt oft ein Vogel, unglaublich laut. Man würde gar nicht meinen, dass ein so lauter Ton aus einem so kleinen Körper kommen kann. Ich glaube, es ist eine Amsel. Vielleicht singt sie hier auch besonders laut, weil sie gegen die Autobahn ankommen muss, die nur wenige Meter hinter dem Grundstück vorbeigeht. Vielleicht ist sie einfach auch nur besonders gut gelaunt, weil jetzt, wo es wieder warm ist, viele Fliegen unterwegs sind. Besonders hier, weil gegenüber liegt die Müllverbrennungsanlage und vor dem Gebäude liegen Silagen voll mit, ich vermute mal, Biomüll. Wenn ich nach Simmering fahre, sage ich, ich fahre in die Natur. Ich habe hier kein Dach über dem Kopf und sehe vorwiegend grün. Und zwar vorwiegend Grünes, das gewachsen und gewuchert ist, ohne von Menschen gepflanzt oder gepflegt worden zu sein. Grün, das ohne menschliches Zutun gewachsen und gewuchert ist, wollte ich fast sagen, aber das ist natürlich nicht richtig. Viele der Pflanzen, Hollerstauden, Klebkraut, Hopfen, Distel, Brennnesseln, Vogelmiere und viele, viele, deren Namen ich nicht kenne, wachsen hier, weil sie weiter oder näher entfernte NachbarInnen gepflanzt haben. Sicherlich wurden viele von weit hierher gebracht, nicht nur in diesen Garten, sondern auf diesen Kontinent. Als erste Spezies, die global mobil wurde, hat der Mensch absichtlich und unabsichtlich auch viele Flora, Fauna und Funga globalisiert. Es gilt also auch nicht nur für diesen Garten in Simmering, sondern für quasi jeden Ort der Erde, dass dort Pflanzentiere und Pilze leben, die ohne die menschliche Mitfahrgelegenheit nicht dort gelandet wären. Für die meisten Menschen ist das wohl noch kein Grund zu sagen, dieser Garten in Simmering gehört nicht zur Natur. Das Geräusch der Autos und der Geruch sind da wohl ausschlaggebender. Je nach Windrichtung riecht es nach Hollerblüten, nach Abgasen oder eben nach Biomüll. Bin ich hier in der Natur? Was heißt es also, sich in der Natur aufzuhalten? Um diese Frage geht es in dieser Ausgabe. Ich werde dazu ein paar Fäden aus einer Ausstellung und drei Büchern ziehen und sie zu möglichen spekulativen Antworten zusammenknüpfen.
Artists, we were thinking about the different aspects and different meanings of nature, different readings of nature, different entanglements that it has between that are existing between technology, between the sort of the originally understood natural world and the cultural world. And we were trying to dissolve dissolve this binary between nature and anything else. So actually showing that the nature that we seek to understand is already part of us.
Das ist Mirela Baczak, Kuratorin der Ausstellung Nature/Nature, die soeben im Kunstraum Niederösterreich in der Wiener Herrengasse eröffnet hat. Es ist die zweite Ausstellung unter der neuen Leitung. Und zwar leitet seit ein paar Monaten Katharina Brandl den Kunstraum Niederösterreich. Und sie lädt dabei sehr spannende Leute ein, sich künstlerisch, aber weitgehend auch kulturwissenschaftlich mit einem Thema zu beschäftigen. Die Kuratorin Mirela Baczak erklärt, worum es in Nature/Nature geht.
About right now, because I was really thinking about language and programming language. I was in the very beginning stage of learning Python, which is one of the programming languages, and this is actually why the backslash became such an important element in the conceptualization of this exhibition. So in computing, when you use a backslash, it tells the interpreter that whatever follows should be treated in a different way than it's usual. So it basically tells the computer that what is meant by, for example, in this case, nature, or whatever follows the backslash, is actually has a different meaning than the one that we are used to. And I was thinking that in the world that we live today, where we actually very take a lot of meanings for granted, what would it be like if we also would have like a backslash, this kind of the ability to use a backslash in our head, and to kind of open up different interpretations of words, not to only stick to one particular meaning or interpretation. Well, nature is actually a word that is a universe of concepts in itself. Because there is no one nature, and this is actually what this exhibition is really about. So the main emphasis is that to show a diversity of natures, and to show that what we actually perceive in this kind of colloquial way as nature is obsolete already, doesn't exist anymore. Also because, as you of course are all aware, our world today is very much influenced by technology. Some theorists even speak of a technosphere as a new geological era. It's also generally acknowledged that we're living in the time of the Anthropocene, which is maybe to my mind a little bit questionable. If the Anthropocene is really like the era of the human, and if we are really in such a dominant position on this earth.
Das Anthropozän. Davon war bei Super Science Me schon öfter die Rede. Nicht zuletzt in der letzten Ausgabe, in der es um Artensterben ging. Der Begriff soll ein neues Erdzeitalter markieren, das durch den menschlichen Einfluss auf den Planeten geprägt ist. Den menschlichen Einfluss auf die chemische Zusammensetzung der Erdoberfläche, der chemischen Zusammensetzung der Atmosphäre und der menschliche Einfluss auf die nichtmenschliche Biodiversität. Dass dieser Einfluss real ist, daran besteht für die Wissenschaft kein Zweifel. Dass die Diagnose Anthropozän richtig und wichtig ist, das bezeugt auch durchaus die Ausstellung Nature/Nature. Wie wir im Laufe dieser Sendung hören werden, geht es vielen der KünstlerInnen darum, das unfassbar umgreifende Phänomen Anthropozän anhand von kleinen Beobachtungen fassbar zu machen. Questionable, wie Mirela Baczak sagte, zweifelhaft ist hingegen, ob wir diese Diagnose gleichzeitig zu unserem Zukunftsnarrativ machen müssen oder sollen. Geht es jetzt nicht genau darum, nicht den Anthropos, den Menschen, ins Zentrum zu stellen, sondern die nichtmenschlichen, vielleicht sogar nicht organischen Erdbewohnerinnen? Zementieren wir den zerstörerischen Einfluss des Menschen nicht viel mehr ein, wenn wir vom Anthropozän sprechen? in den Kunstraum Niederösterreich und zum Beitrag von Nicolas Hoffmann.
Nicolas, it's also video installation of entitled A Perfect Cloud. And it's a very actually strong, quirky, and powerful piece that takes you to quite another universe. Nicolas, would you like to say something to your chicken?
Yeah, it's a giant chicken head. I made this video in collaboration with a friend of mine, Nadia Perlov, and also my partner, who is a musician. And yeah, it's a video that follows a chicken from the future who lands on planet Earth and then sings a few songs and kind of gets like poetic about Earth. Yeah. It's a chicken from the future. It just seemed like a nice idea to make a chicken from the future. Also, like, yeah, this kind of, I'm a little bit against this like Anthropocene stuff, like this grand narrative of humans being super important. And I think, yeah, I always try to work with like humor. So there's that joke, you know, like, why did the chicken cross the road? But Laura and I were thinking like, oh, why did the chicken cross the galaxy?
Und Nicolas Hoffmann und die ebenso in der Schau vertretene Künstlerin Hui Ye haben auch Songs geschrieben, die Tiere und ihre Handlungsmacht im Zentrum haben. Zum Beispiel Cat Control, zu finden im Katalog zur Ausstellung.
And I think in these songs it's also you're also in an interesting way like switch the gaze around with the Cat Control, for example, song, which is like, it's actually about like when you look at this cat on the internet, is it actually, you know, are you looking at it or is it looking at you? Like, who's actually in control more there? Who's possessing you? Who's possessing whom more?
Totally. Yeah. And like that thing of, yeah, like cats taking over the internet. Yeah. And then like Hui and I were thinking, oh, because we were looking at a lot of these old, like 13th century scores, which a lot of like this idea of like the birth of polyphony in voice and this attachment to the church, and that sound was also this very sacred thing, which is very different from, I mean, of course, images as well, but like this sort of, yeah, like this logic of like, okay, if cats are on everyone's like fucking Instagram all the time, then what happens if they like take over all communication? Which is kind of dark, but yeah, again, this like sort of
it's a good exercise for imagination, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, and you can actually sing the scores; they are performable for two voices.
Ein tolles Buch, das die Beziehung zwischen Mensch und Tier verkompliziert bzw. nicht in einer einfachen Kultur-Natur-Gegenüberstellung zeigt, ist Fahim Amirs Schwein und Zeit. Tiere, Politik, Revolte, 2018 im Nautilus Verlag erschienen. Den vorherrschenden Positionen in der Tierfrage wird hier ein anderer Blickwinkel gegenübergestellt. Hier geht es darum, die Geschichte der Tiere als Teil von Klassengesellschaften aus einer Perspektive der Kämpfe zu denken. Hat Marx die Hegelsche Dialektik vom Kopf auf die Füße gestellt, wie es gemeinhin heißt, so ist es damit noch nicht getan. Sie muss auf die Hufe und Pfoten gestellt werden. Fahim Amir, Schwein und Zeit. Fahim Amir geht es in Schwein und Zeit darum aufzuzeigen, dass ein allzu romantisches Bild einer unberührten Natur nicht hilfreich ist, um den nichtmenschlichen Bewohnerinnen auf Augenhöhe und mit Respekt zu begegnen. Die tierethisch vorherrschende Frage, können sie leiden, weicht hier einem anderen Interesse. Wo und wie leisten und leisteten Tiere Widerstand? Und wo gibt und gab es KampfgefährtInnenschaften zwischen Menschen und Tieren? Daraus kann Solidarität entstehen, statt bloß paternalistisches Mitleid. Statt Tiere als Opfer und schutzbedürftige, fragile Wesen zu beschreiben, porträtiert er widerständige Schweine bzw. schweinische Multituden und erzählt die Geschichte des Hausschweins als eine Geschichte von Klassenkämpfen. Er stellt sich vor, wie sich Tiere, die unter dem Berliner Club Berghain wohnen, die psychoaktiven Substanzen, die in ihre Behausungen in der Kanalisation gespült werden, willkommen heißen und sich berauschen. Er beschreibt, wie Singvögel Hormone aus Kläranlagen picken und daraufhin zu neuem Gesprächsrepertoire inspiriert werden und sich erfolgreicher fortpflanzen. Und. Dies wirkt kontraintuitiv. Schließlich haben wir in zahllosen, traurigen David Attenborough-Dokumentationen gelernt, dass die Existenz des Menschen nur Elend über die Welt der wilden Tiere gebracht hat. Die Gesangsvirtuosen Hormonvögel widersetzen sich diesem Bild. Sie wirken wie ein indigener Stamm, der nicht bei einem ethnoromantischen Musikvideo von Sting mitmachen will. Fahim Amir, Schwein und Zeit. Ihr hört Super Science Me, Wissenschaft und Fiktion auf Radio Orange 94.0. Wir machen uns anlässlich der Ausstellung Nature/Nature, die gerade im Kunstraum Niederösterreich in Wien zu sehen ist, Gedanken zu verschiedenen Verständnissen davon, was Natur bedeuten kann und soll. Wir hören Auszüge aus der Kuratorinnenführung durch Nature/Nature von Mirela Batschak.
And yeah, so maybe now I would switch to the first work, which is the collection of Diana Lelonek, entitled Center of Living Things. So Center of Living Things is actually a research institute, and it's an ongoing endeavor of Diana, who goes to different sites, such as forests, riversides, but also illegal dump waste. And she looks for objects in which there came to a certain collision, so to speak, or certain merging between waste and natural and nature, like plants and different organisms. I think this work is very, very, very essential, actually, for what we were discussing, like with all the artists in this exhibition. That is this mutual desire between nature and culture, and how it actually is one instead of being like two separate entities. So what is actually very interesting is that Poland is one of the only countries in the European Union where the waste sort of policies are not yet regulated. So Poland is a country where lots of EU countries send their waste to. For example, we get waste from Switzerland because it's cheaper and easier to burn, and of course it results in extreme pollution, as you might know. But Diana also investigates like these different relations, and she has two ways of displaying the objects. One are in this kind of aquarium, which is a specially built aquarium that has holes here, so that there is a good atmosphere for the different species to live. And every 4 hours there is a watering system which turns on and gives and kind of nourishes the species. And so you can see here an old shoe. On which there is a plant growing. You can see different kinds of moss that are merging with dust. You can see an old carpet, which also became a habitat for a particular kind of moss. Maybe let's then go to the next work, to the Agency of Singular Investigations. So this is a work of Agency of Singular Investigations entitled The Botanical Political Lexicon. And it is a part from the Flower Power Archive. Flower Power was a secret society which presumably lived in Russia in the 19th century. And it was a group that was secretly meeting and developing like techniques of or believing that actually one can influence politics through through nature. So these atlases have this kind of have a reference to the also the way of encyclopedia, and they present they juxtapose silhouettes of flowers and the names of flowers together with the political notions of the 20th century. It's interesting that they work a lot with fiction. So to be honest, every time I talk to them, they were kind of switching about the Flower Power archive. They were playing with me if it's really existing or not existing. To be honest, I'm not sure until to this day. And this is also part of the work that they make it so ambivalent, that they really play with the way they work with history and these notions.
Auf das Geschichten erzählen, auf die Fiktion setzen, um so auf neue Wege des Zusammenlebens zu kommen. Dies ist eine Strategie der amerikanischen Philosophin, die in Super Science Me zugegebenermaßen omnipräsent ist, nämlich Donna Haraway. Inspiriert von ihrer Arbeit sowie den Texten der Science-Fiction-Autorin Ursula K. Le Guin, haben zahlreiche und sehr verschiedene Autorinnen Essays geschrieben, die solchen Geschichten eines Multispezies-Zusammenleben auf einem beschädigten Planeten erzählen. Sie sind 2017 in dem Band Arts of Living on a Damaged Planet erschienen. Herausgegeben von Anna Zing, Heather Swanson, Elaine Gann und Nils Buband bei der University of Minnesota Press. As humans reshape the landscape, we forget what was there before. Ecologists call this forgetting the shifting baseline syndrome. Our newly shaped and ruined landscapes become the new reality. Admiring one landscape and its biological entanglements often entails forgetting many others. Forgetting in itself remakes landscapes, as we privilege some assemblages over others. Yet ghosts remind us. Ghosts point to our forgetting, showing us how living landscapes are imbued with earlier tracks and traces. Auch hier geht es also darum, das Anthropozän als Diagnose ernst zu nehmen, aber den Menschen ein Stück weit in den Hintergrund treten zu lassen, wenn es darum geht, die Zukunft zu erzählen. Our use of the term Anthropocene does not imagine a homogeneous human race. We write in dialogue with those who remind readers of unequal relations among humans, industrial ecologies and human insignificance in the web of life, by writing instead of Capitolocene, Plantationocene or Cthulucene, see Haraway. Our use of Anthropocene intends to join the conversation, but not to accept the worst uses of the term, from green capitalism to techno-positivist hubris. Arts of Living on a Damaged Planet. Edited by Anna Zink, Heather Swanson, Elaine Gann, Nils Buband. Ihr hört Super Science Me, Wissenschaft und Fiktion auf Radio Orange. Hören wir noch einmal in den Kunstraum Niederösterreich zu Nature/Nature. Wir hören Flavio Rogocan, der über seine Arbeit Does Looking at a Picture of the Sun Hurt Your Eyes spricht.
So to tell you about this work, I found this question which was asked online on Yahoo Answers, which says, does looking at a picture of the sun hurt your eyes? Which is quite a silly question at the first reading, but I like to take it quite literal and quite seriously and take this as a kind of a metaphor about the power of digital images to hurt in a way. And the way it's shown here, it's a error which early digital cameras had, where if you were taking a picture of a really bright light, the sensor would kind of oversaturate and it would turn out a black circle instead of the sun. So it ends up making these eclipse-like images because of an error, in a way. So it's kind of the both things of both hurting your eyes physically while looking at it. It's quite hard because it's so bright, but it's also hurting the digital eye of the camera in a way. Yeah, and I think it's interesting, like coming back to nature a bit, how it's usually when technology fails that we perceive it as being a more natural thing, as these errors, which can be also the technological errors.
Mit einer bestimmten technologischen Entwicklung beschäftigt sich auch der Künstler Anders Eierbacke.
Drone technology is a part of a technological revolution, but also an existential leap forward. Because if you look into the drones, they are comprising of sensors that are basically reproducing human senses. So the sensors that I'm employing here, like the gyro, the accelerometer, the GPS, etc., they're all referring to our human bodies and the way we function. Even the camera, which is an optical sensor, is referring to our eyes, right? So I have this humanistic perspective on drones, and but also I have this political thing that in like the first 5-6 years when I was working with drones, I was usually flying over military bases in mostly Norway without permission. So I was filming especially the Norwegian special forces that were training for going to Afghanistan. And this was part of a political discussion about Norwegian military participation. And I also did a project over the Norwegian parliament, which was about how Norway is outsourcing, or how the West, how NATO and the Western powers are basically outsourcing military action to mechanized units such as drones. But in the same time, controlling those war tools from home, which means that we are both taking out, for example, the pilot from the aircraft so that we don't risk downing Western pilots over enemy territories. But at the same time, we are taking the decisions home. So, for example, in Nevada or in a base in Norway, people are actively participating in warfare, which makes those bases as legitimate targets. And this is a very important discussion that is very seldomly brought into media.
In Nature/Nature steht also eine Drohne von Andres Eierbacke. Sie hat die Form einer Krähe und sie fliegt zur Performance im Ausstellungsraum aus.
Hi, I'm Daria. I come myself from St. Petersburg in Russia, but I've been living between New York, Vienna, St. Petersburg, and Santiago in Chile, everywhere having family, so quite of covering the whole planet a bit. And here is a piece which is called No se están metiendo el pico en el ojo, which is a Chilean proverb, which is translated into English as they're putting a dick in our eyes. And very often people are referring by this proverb to the skyscrapers wave that kind of flushed to the whole planet, and especially the capital of Santiago, Chile, where recently they built the tallest skyscraper in the southern hemisphere on planet Earth, which became kind of a symbol of neoliberal kind of glory in the country of Chile. And in the main video, I'm basically tracing through a very straightforward voiceover, I'm tracing the process of colonization of indigenous groups that originally lived in Chile. They were colonized by Spanish Catholics in 16th century. And then the Chilean society was colonized in 1973 by USA military coup d'etat and pushed the democratically elected social leader by the the military dictator Pinochet. And at that time, the neoliberal economics was implanted in the country of Chile. So kind of forcefully, it was pushed from socialism into neoliberalism. And nowadays, it's accelerated to the extent that from just an economic system, it became a very strong kind of belief system. So I'm kind of tracing that change and mutation of beliefs and juxtaposing the indigenous beliefs on subjects of death, relationship, time, economy, health, with the contemporary more familiar to us Westerners, so to say, subjects of that matter. And I'm placing that main video in a larger like group of installation, which consists of 44 canvases of different shapes and sizes. And here I wanted to take the indigenous Chilean Mapuche and the Aguirre textile patterns, deconstruct them, and also use the linen, the textiles, and put the pigments, the natural pigments on top of them. But also, once I was working on the design, I found a lot of similarities, for example, with the Russian constructivism style from the beginning of 20th century, which kind of works in my mind really well. It's kind of collapse of crossing of different cultures. And the two side videos are slowly changing colors, which kind of juxtaposes with the natural pigments, where one can trace the 30,000 year evolution of humankind from extracting pigments from minerals or from plants. And nowadays using colors in like RGB scale, where you can program any type of color in by three numbers, basically.
The question I had from the presentations was, there is always, when we think about nature in the art context right now, what in my observation, this dualism between optimism and pessimism, or maybe it's not a dualism, but like a scale. Mm-hmm. And this is also what has been referred to as the Anthropocene. So should we name it this or not, and how to situate oneself in this in this scale of optimism and pessimism? So I wondered, what do you think about the works that I've presented here on in this respect?
I think, I mean, definitely I wanted to omit any kind of demonizing of like going too much to the one way or the other. I think the works really oscillate, like some of them, for example, the work of Agency is a rather dystopian, has this dystopian dark touch, you know, of this very dark, of the dark nature, as well as in the moments where like Omer Vasim pinpoints the situation in Karachi, or Daria Irincheva in her video shows how the landscape of Santiago is being transformed by neoliberalism and capital, basically. I don't think it's demonizing, but it's it definitely shows that that we are going into the direction that that is alarming. But I think also these artists, like in the case of Omer, he proposes the strategy of slowing down and, you know, kind of contemplating more, which is maybe, of course, one thing that that we all can do, think of. And the same with Daria Irincheva, like she draws attention to the indigenous practices and interpretations and a kind of counter position to this turbo capitalist development.
Mm-hmm. So it's also about to find inspiration to new ways of living somehow or situating oneself towards nature?
Yes, it's more about unlocking this one way of thinking about things in general, but in this particular case, of course, about nature. It's about opening up to different interpretations and more inviting a reflection. And I think through this, like through this exposure to artworks, through this exposure of different contexts, then maybe it's a very individual process, but then I think it then evokes, you know, thinking, and it evokes a change of perspective in one's own position.
Die Kuratorin Mirela Batschak im Interview. Ein Buch, das man wahrlich als nicht optimistisch bezeichnen kann, ist Losing Earth von Nathaniel Rich. Im April 2019 erschienen, in der gleichnamigen deutschen Übersetzung bei Rowohlt. Wir denken nicht gerne an Verlust oder Tod. Besonders Amerikaner denken nicht gerne daran. Man kann den Umgang mit dem Klimawandel noch so obsessiv verfolgen, es bleibt trotzdem schwierig, nüchtern über eine existenzielle Bedrohung der Spezies nachzudenken. Unser Unbehagen beeinflusst sogar die Sprache, in der wir das Thema kleiden. Die banalen Bezeichnungen Erderwärmung und Klimawandel sind eine linguistische Entsprechung zu den Schutzhandschuhen, die man überstreift, um eine blutende Wunde abzutasten. Nathaniel Rich, Losing Earth. Nathaniel Rich erzählt in Losing Earth die Geschichte der Erkenntnis, dass der Anstieg von CO2 in der Atmosphäre die Erde und ihr Klima radikal verändern wird. Er zeigt dies anhand von Dokumenten aus dem späten 19. Jahrhundert, die bereits festhalten, dass durch die industrielle Revolution nun viel mehr Kohlenstoff frei werde und dies Umweltveränderungen bedeuten wird, dann über anfängliche politische Diskussionen in den 1970er Jahren und schließlich einem Woodstock des Klimawandels Ende der 1980er Jahre, wo es in der politischen Landschaft der USA fast so aussieht, als könnten sich die Lobbyistinnen für den Klimaschutz Gehör verschaffen. Nämlich ist das der Zeitpunkt, als das Phänomen Ozonloch aufkommt, das für mediale Aufbereitung besser geeignet war als der stetig ansteigende CO2-Überschuss. Schließlich, so die Conclusio, sei aber nichts bzw. viel zu wenig von den vorgeschlagenen Maßnahmen umgesetzt worden. Das horrende Bild, das Nathaniel Rich zeichnet, besteht nicht nur aus der Tatsache, dass bereits in den 1970er Jahren über menschengemachten Klimawandel so einiges bekannt war und es seither vollkommen verabsäumt wurde, tatsächlich wirksame Schritte zu setzen, sondern auch aus seiner Feststellung, dass man vor 40 bis 50 Jahren sogar mehr wusste, in dem Sinn, dass man auf die wissenschaftliche Forschung, die auf diesem Gebiet gemacht wurde, vertraute. Alle wussten sie Bescheid. Und wir wissen es immer noch. Wir wissen, dass der schrittweise oder auch schlagartige Wandel unseres Planeten die ganze Weltordnung verändern wird. Wir wissen, dass wir den Untergang unserer Zivilisation riskieren, wenn wir die Emissionen nicht drastisch reduzieren. Nathaniel Rich, Losing Earth.
Okay, so we'll continue with the work of Omer Vasim. I'm very, very happy that Omer managed to come to Vienna from Karachi. And his work is actually also a form of a very poetic dialogue and conversation with an inanimate object, with a stone from Karachi. And Omer, maybe you can tell a little bit more about this.
Hi, how are you guys? I'm Omer. I live in Karachi, and this is a collaborative work. So this is about a stone that we picked up from the coastline, close to the coastline, and that is where our studio is, very, very close to the beach in Karachi. And that area is owned and operated by the Pakistan Army, so we are thinking about military power and how military in Pakistan owns a lot of land and has a lot of power, but then also has a lot of access to capital. And so we are thinking about how the coastline is in flux, it's changing, it's being pushed out to make more room for concrete. So nature here is in diametric opposition to aspirations, right? So Karachi is a city that's kind of constantly sort of, I shouldn't say that it needs to be saved, but it is a city that needs that aspirations are sort of growing and growing and growing, and there's no way to accommodate it, right? So that the land is literally, the water is being literally pushed out to make more room for concrete to accommodate military's interest in more power, more wealth. So I think that my interest in my father's a geologist, so I'm interested in geology, and then to kind of think about how these things bear witness to acts of erasures, right? So I'm kind of interested. Sarah and I were very, very interested in those moments, and how something that seemingly has no value has probably perhaps seen more than any of us probably will ever. To kind of thinking about deep time bearing witness and countering acts of erasures, right? So it's a very simple gesture, struggling with the stone, trying to figure it out, decipher it, stay with it. It's a moment of slowing down. Yeah, and then also I think it's kind of important to also realize that those videos, even though they are videos, they don't register as videos because there's absolutely no camera movement. So you think of it as a static image, but I mean, it is changing, right? I think that we also need to realize that matter is like perhaps always changing, and we are always changing too. So that things that make us up are never the same. So the stone is actually in flux while you're looking at it, even though it seems to be static.
In the midst of disaster, stones bring a gift of hope, of fortune, of insight, of the possibility of living with. In the Anthropocene, multiple conversations with stones are necessary. After all, the Anthropocene is a geological epoch, proposed by geologists, climate chemists and stratigraphers, scientists used to studying stones, rocks, sediments, and chemical cycles. In the Anthropocene, they suggest humans have become a geological force. Arts of Living on a Damaged Planet. Edited by Anna Zink, Heather Swanson, Elaine Gann, Niels Bubant. Gelocktes Metall, fast quallenähnlich, darunter eine giftgrüne, dicke Lacke. Fest oder ist sie doch flüssig? Die Arbeit, Unintended Dosages, Unknown Supplier, Hair Will Grow, von Julia Znoi.
Julia?
This is a work I did for now, like it kind of finished yesterday also, and it's called Unintended Dosages, Unknown Supplier, Hair Will Grow, and it is talking about somehow how, like, we can conceive these as different materials collaborating, also collaborating with the space. This is sugar, this is metal smithed that I did with fire twisting, not controlling the material so much as to not have the gesture of confining it too much or like wanting to make this horizontal sculpture, but somehow having it break like an ornament, or somehow like a structure, a bodily structure that is breaking, and talking more about memory or reconfiguring and like the body and change. So they are moving towards each other, but also simultaneously reaching out. So there's a lot about like weight, the fabric is holding weight, the sugar is like somehow referencing a thinking space, a pond where things can emerge, but also leaking very much. And it could attract animals, it could attract the eye, or the want, the human wanting to touch it. And these things interest me.
Fahim Amir, Schwein und Zeit. Über den Club Berghain in Berlin. Den echten Underground findet man noch weiter unten in der Kanalisation. Denn all die Drogen, die da oben konsumiert werden, müssen ja auch mal raus. Sie fließen in die Kanalisation hinab, wo die dort lebenden Tiere in wahren Duschen von Hormonen und anderen potenten Molekülen gebadet werden. Es gibt zwar keine Forschung zu diesem besonderen Habitat urbaner Ökologie, aber warum sollte es hier nicht amphetamin-gedopte Ratten geben, die vor sich hin raven, hochfrequent kopulierende Kakerlaken auf Kokain, kuscheltrunken aneinander abrutschende Kröten auf MDMA oder Ketaminmäuse in psychoaktiver Dissoziation? Natur ähnelt manchmal eben mehr einem Punkrock-Konzert als der Hausordnung eines Freizeitresorts in Dubai. Fahim Amir, Schwein und Zeit. Neben den bereits genannten künstlerischen Positionen gibt es bei Nature/Nature auch eine Videoinstallation von Hui Ye zu sehen. Hier macht sie sich Gedanken über den Garten als domestizierte Naturminiatur.
I make a kind of so guided meditation in a Zen garden.
Außerdem gibt es eine Performance von Thomas Geiger, der mit der Büste von Friedrich Wilhelm Heinrich Reifeisen in Dialog tritt. Die steht nämlich im Innenhof des Kunstraum Niederösterreichs in der Herrengasse. Er spricht mit der Büste unter anderem darüber, was Reifeisens Reformen mit Vulkanausbrüchen zu tun
haben. Das hat zu so viel Ascheausstoß geführt, dass das Wetter in Mitteleuropa beeinflusst wurde.
I think the like the coming together of language and nature is particularly interesting also because nature or wildness or whatever is something that is defined by somehow that we can't really capture it in language, yeah. But at the same time, it's language that we use to relate to nature. So yes. It's also, again, this dualism. Definitely. On the one side, a prison, on the other hand, also yeah. A relationship yeah. That can be yeah. Built up yeah. With that.
But this was actually one of the biggest struggles for me, but also for the artists, especially during our work on the catalog. You know, how do we, even if I say we, it's already like, who is we? You know, we, the humans, how do we assume what is nature? How do we actually, how the way we use grammar and language actually already claims as if we represent, as if we could represent nature as such, you know, as if we could speak for the many, as we, but I think it's actually, it's a difficult, you know, it's really a difficult thing. And I mean, up to now, we are all kind of looking for words, how to speak about nature, not from this, you know, very privileged central position. And I don't know if it's possible. I mean, maybe that's why, you know, there's the language of art and different other forms that allow to speak about it in a less dominant way.
Mirela Batschak, Kuratorin von Nature/Nature, im Interview am Ende dieser Ausgabe von Super Science Me. Die Ausstellung ist noch bis zum 27. Juli 2019 im Kunstraum Niederösterreich in der Herrengasse in Wien zu sehen. Weiterführende Informationen dazu und zu den zitierten Büchern gibt es auf der Sendungsseite von Super Science Me auf o94.at sowie in den Shownotes zum Podcast, der unter superscience.podigy.io abonniert werden kann. Super Science Me gibt es wieder am 9. Juli und da widmen wir uns einem Tier, das ebenso die Grenzen zwischen Wildnis und Stadt vollkommen brüchig werden lässt. Wir widmen uns den Krähen bzw. genereller den Rabenvögeln. Julia Grillmeier war an den Radioreglern. Danke fürs Zuhören und bis bald bei Super Science Me.